Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redman, and you can find all of my work by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Well, today on the show, we have a very special guest, and we're going to be talking about a very important topic, one that is something that everybody should really know about and should understand and should be exploring, and that is the genocide in Rwanda and the ultimate destruction of Central Africa that emanated out from that. And to talk with us about this today is a very special guest, as I said, one of my favorite journalists on the planet, and that is Keith Harmon Snow. He has worked all over Africa, including in Congo, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, and Sudan. He is a former genocide and war crimes investigator for groups such as Genocide Watch and even the United Nations. And he has testified at numerous immigration asylum hearings for Rwandan and Congolese refugees, and also testified at a very important trial in Spain, which we'll probably get to, that led to the indictment of over 40 top Rwandan RPF officers. So, Keith Harmon Snow, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Pierce.
So, as I was saying in the beginning, you know, we're going to be talking about Rwanda, and this is the 20th anniversary of the genocide, which began on April 7th, 1994, and lasted to about July 1994, this 100 days. And this is something that, of course, every time it comes up in the media, there's a big, obviously a big deal should be made about it, but we get this sort of same narrative that gets hammered into us over and over and over again. And we hear these phrases like never again, we've got to, you know, we've got to do something, we can't sit by and watch. And unfortunately, this official narrative has just become the absolute scripture, the absolute truth, supposedly, on what happened in Rwanda. And Keith, your work has really, in the past couple of years, opened up my eyes to the reality of this situation. And as you know, as I'm saying that this, the official narrative, we'll just sort of get it out there quickly, is that for this 100 days, extremist Hutus, who were being orchestrated from the very top of the Hutu-led government at that time, butchered anywhere between 800,000 and 1.2 million Tutsis using more or less just machetes. And that it was the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, led by Paul Kagame, who is still the leader, that ended the violence. And as we're going to see, this is not really quite the case, but I think before we get into the intricacies and the complexities of what happened, Keith, perhaps first you can kind of set up the background and the political structure of Rwanda, you know, prior to all of this, starting, you know, under the Tutsi monarchy.
Sure. I want to point out that I'm not an expert on the historiography of Rwanda. So because we have the colonial imperial propaganda apparatus, there's a lot of books out there about the history of Rwanda that are biased by various factors. For example, whiteness. Mm. So if you go to an academic's early articles, early reports, early books about Rwanda, you may find that it's very accurate, and that academic has been very forthright in making sure that they present the historiography of the relationships between the Hutu people and the Tutsi people, for example, accurately. And you also, there's plenty of examples of absolute nonsense out there where they've got some sort of a bias or other. But if you didn't know any better, you could read that stuff. And many academics do. Many students do. They read it. They think that it's an academic. It's rigorous research. But it's really based in some extreme, in many cases, some extreme bias, such as, and most poignantly, whiteness, which is something we really should talk about. And as far as Rwanda goes, I mean, nothing has been more influential in being able to create this very racist, reductionist narrative, which just distills the story down to a few simple facts that the white reading news, so-called news consuming public, likes to consume. And that would be that, as you said, it was 100 days of genocide, began on April 6, 1994, as if there was no previous history, as if there was no previous relationship between the Hutus and the Tutsis, for example. So what is the previous relationship? There's first of all, the most important thing to understand genocide in Rwanda is to understand that the genocide in Rwanda began October 1st, 1990, a very influential, pivotal day when the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was a bunch of Ugandans backed by the United States, Britain, and Israel, invaded a sovereign nation. They invaded the sovereign nation of Rwanda. Regardless of what the government in Rwanda was like at the time, it was an invasion by a guerrilla army that, for example, if it was an invasion against the United States, you can imagine our leaders screaming bloody murder that we've just been invaded. But in the case of Rwanda, we supported these guys who invaded from Uganda. And so the media actually supported the so-called rebel cause. The Rwandan Patriotic Front is known as the rebel. So that's an interesting point. So let's go further back beyond 1990 and understand that the government of Juvenal Habyarimana that was in power in 1990, and Habyarimana was assassinated on the first of those 100 days, April 6, 1994. Habyarimana came to power in 1973. He was backed by France. And France at the time unseated Belgian post-colonial control of Rwanda. So Belgium controlled Rwanda from the end of World War II until 1959-1960, which was the date of the so-called Hutu Revolution, where the majority Hutu people rose up with the support of the Belgian Catholic priests. And the Catholic priests from Belgium were seeing this incredible injustice amongst the people of the Hutu people and the Tutsi people, where the Tutsi monarchy in control, the Tutsi elites in control in Rwanda, backed by the Belgians, were absolute oppressors against the Hutu majority. And you can imagine, if for example, there's 20% Tutsis in Rwanda, 80% Hutus, how does a 20% majority control an 20% minority control an 80% majority? And the answer is, you have something akin to white-based slavery that we had in the United States from 1650 or whenever it began to officially 1865 or something like that. So go even further back. In the beginning, meaning before the white man arrived in Rwanda-Urundi, that region, the place was occupied by Hutu and Tutsi people, and 1% of the country is Twa, which would be the indigenous people of the country. And the Hutus back in 1885, for example, which is the date of the Berlin Conference where Africa was divided up by the European powers, in 1885, the Hutu people were oppressed by the Tutsi monarchy. There were Tutsi kings. There were also at one point Hutu kings, but the Tutsi kings had sovereignty over the Hutu majority, the Hutu masses. And for example, the Tutsi kings would have these processions, and the Tutsi official drum had hanging from it the testicles of a Hutu male. So this was a symbol by the Tutsi monarchy to the Hutu people that we are in control. We'll cut your fucking balls off if you get out of line. So I'll try to restrict my language to...
Oh, no. You can curse as much as you want.
Well, it's just So the Hutus were given this signal, for example, of having their testicles hanging from the official royal drum. And that was before the Germans took control. And they did not take control of Rwanda in 1885. They took control of Rwanda after a conference in Brussels in 1890, where Rwanda-Urundi was given to the Germans. So from 1890 to the end of World War I, the Germans controlled Rwanda-Urundi by supporting the Tutsi monarchy to oppress the Hutu masses. And again, this was brutal, brutal imperial colonial repression and oppression of the Hutu masses and plenty of Tutsis. So let's go back again to the Tutsi-Hutu thing. If you read, for example, the New Yorker magazine, who's talked at length about the so-called tribal situation in Rwanda, presenting a lot of propaganda that has really brainwashed the American public, the Canadian public, the European public's minds. And again, this is the New Yorker magazine. One of the things we're never told about the Hutus and the Tutsis is that they're not tribes. A Hutu could become a Tutsi. It was very, very rare, by gaining enough cattle. So the Tutsi were the cattle herders, the cattle bearers, the cattle owners. They were the elites. They had the cattle. They had the more lucrative food supply, milk, beef, etc. The Hutus were the agricultural peasants, the agricultural masses. And you can picture this just like your any kind of European kingdom, where you had slaves occupying the fields and the Tutsi monarchy occupying the castles. In this case, they were just, more exotic exotic is a very dangerous word to use when talking about Africa because it's loaded with racism, but more exotic villages. Mm. So the Tutsis in control could also, a Tutsi elite could lose their power by losing their cattle. And if they lost all their cattle, they would become a Hutu. So according to the tribal definition, the tribology of the West, this does not make sense. Because Rwanda, genocide in Rwanda, and we have to define what we mean by genocide in Rwanda, is not about tribes. It was not about Hutus and Tutsis as tribes. It was about economics. Mm. It was about imperialism, imperial control, and the invasion and occupation of a sovereign nation by a guerrilla, savage guerrilla army. And by savage, I mean, picture the pictures from the 1980s coming out of Latin America that made it into the world press, showing the hillsides of Honduras with decapitated bodies, massacres of entire villages. Some of this made it into the world press from Latin America. And this was by the, this was committed by, these were atrocities committed by the Reagan administration covert forces and backed, and armies in Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, backed, and Nicaragua, of course, backed by the Reagan and the Bush number one administrations. So this is the kind of terrorism that we, that you see committed from the beginning by the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was really a bunch of Ugandans coming in 1990 and taking control of a country by force, by coup d'etat. So step back again to the German colonial occupation. The Tutsis were kept in control by the German system. They supported the Tutsi monarchy. The Tutsi monarchy oppressed the Hutu masses. Germany made a ton of money. It all comes down to making a ton of money in the Congo. King Leopold, Belgium was built on the oppression of the Congolese people. It was built on the red rubber trade, and we call it red rubber because it's blood rubber. The rubber was made by absolute slavery. And you can read all about this by this great white academic researcher, Adam Hochschild, in his book, King Leopold's Ghost. And I make a point of pointing out that Adam Hochschild is a white academic researcher because he is a privileged member of the elite from the United States. And therefore, you have to take his book with a little bit of grain of salt and remember that. Remember that it's a fantastic account of oppression under King Leopold, but that Adam Hochschild doesn't tell you everything because he's another white guy who's created a historiography of the Congo. What we need is a people's history of the Congo, like a people's history of the United States. Mm. And it would be very different from what Adam Hochschild has created. Nonetheless, that book was fantastic in documenting and producing evidence and showing what happened in the Congo. And it was all about money. For example, Israel was built on the blood diamonds coming out of Africa. It was all about money. People don't know this about the Israel being built on the diamond trade out of Africa.
Yes.
So back to Rwanda, Burundi, the Germans maintained it until they were defeated at the end of World War I. It was given then to Belgium. Belgium from 1916 until 1960. That's where the Catholic priests started to see the oppression and started to support the Hutu masses who were denied basic education. And they were able to get basic education because the education from the colonial apparatus was going strictly to the Tutsi elites. And so the Belgian clergy, the Catholic priests, brought education to some Hutu people through the church. And through this, they used liberation theology to bring the Hutu people to a place by 1959, 1960 of fighting for the liberation of their people, the Hutu people, against the Tutsi oppressors. Their enemy was the Tutsi oppressors. Their enemy above that, the next layer, was, of course, Belgium. But their immediate enemy was the Tutsi oppressors. So 1960, we have the Hutu Revolution. And remember, all around the world, this is the so-called end of colonialism. Late 40s, early 50s, India had just won independence from Britain. Malaysia, Indonesia, Brazil, Vietnam, all these countries were having resistance struggles and achieving so-called independence. Same thing with Rwanda. So 1960, the Hutus foment a revolution. They take control. Belgium sniffs the winds of change and realizes that in order to maintain its interests, it needs to back the Hutus now. It starts backing the Hutus. And what do you think happens with the Tutsi oppressors? They flee the country. These are the so-called refugees. The oppressors flee Rwanda, 1959, 1960, that was the first major flight of Tutsi refugees. There would be more Tutsi refugees to flee over the 1960s and early 1970s. But these Tutsis who fled were the elites. They were the people in control. It was like the people who controlled Cuba. And backed by the United States, who fled when Castro took over. And they fled to Miami, and they started screaming bloody murder. And, of course, they were supported by, in screaming bloody murder, they were given a voice, they were given a platform to scream bloody murder because they had been they were backed by powerful people in the United States who had interests and who had were losing money because this nasty revolutionary Fidel Castro came to power. So back to Rwanda, we have the Belgians switch places with they switch the Hutus for the Tutsis. They backed the Hutu revolution. They helped to get a Hutu president in power, and the Tutsis flee to Uganda, Tanzania. Some went to Kenya, Zambia, but most of them went to Uganda, Tanzania, Belgium, or Europe, and the United States. And at the time, 1960, Paul Kagame, the current dictator in Rwanda, was 2 years old. He fled, his family fled to Uganda, along with a lot of other Tutsis, and they were refugees in the beginning in Uganda. But it wasn't long. This was, again, 1960s, and I'm not going to talk too much about the history of violence and imperialism in Uganda, but it's important to point out a few key facts. So the Tutsis who arrived in Uganda in the 1960s was soon under the first administration of Milton Obote, who became labeled as a socialist, or even, you know, any socialist is a communist by default. Right. By default. So this guy was a socialist, a communist. And the first Obote regime was overthrown. I'm not sure of the exact details. I think Idi Amin came in next, but there may have been somebody in between. But Idi Amin is an important landmark, or pivotal guy. Everybody, or almost everybody, has heard of Idi Amin. He's like the quintessential African terrorist. Yes. Dictator. You know, you just watch the Hollywood film, The Last King of Scotland. Mm. I mean, he hangs this guy by meat hooks, this white guy who, of course, is the hero in the Last King of Scotland. He's the victim and the hero at the same time, because that's the way Hollywood did it. He's the Tarzan of that film. Just like Ben Affleck is the Tarzan of the Congo today, and Jane Goodall was the Tarzan Jane of Rwanda, and Sigourney Weaver in the movie Gorillas in the Mist, she plays the role of who's that famous gorilla researcher?
Diane Fossey.
Another Jane in the Congo. So this Last King of Scotland, you've got this white guy playing this role, and that's the racism in that film, which is an absolute fiction. The entire film is fiction. Idi Amin was brought to power by Israel. Idi Amin was brought to power by Britain and the United States behind Israel. Israel was at the time in the 1970s prosecuting some wars around the planet and was needing some staunch allies against the government of Sudan, the government of Ethiopia, et cetera, et cetera. And so they supported Idi Amin to come to power. Idi Amin, of course, wanted more power than Israel, the United States, and Britain wanted to give him. So before long, he was starting to ask for jet fighters beyond what they'd already given him. And he turned to Russia and Libya, and he got some MiGs from Libya. And that, of course, Libya, Gaddafi being another quintessential Arab terrorist, that was like the worst thing you could do to the Reagan administration or the Bush administration or the Carter administration. And so Idi Amin became the world's greatest terrorist almost overnight, regardless of what he had done. So then they had to get rid of this guy, Idi Amin. So that was when there was some support of this guy, Milton Obote. Tanzanians, with the support of Museveni, the president of Uganda, and Paul Kagame from Uganda, these are the guys who helped to overthrow in the beginning Idi Amin and support the coming to power of Milton Obote II, which was another return of this socialist government that the world didn't want, the United States, the capitalist system didn't want. So they had to get rid of Obote II, and that's when Museveni invaded Uganda, the early 1980s, from 1980 to 1985. The National Resistance Movement, led by Yoweri Museveni, the current dictator in Uganda, And his number one director of military intelligence was Paul Kagame, the dictator fascist in Rwanda. And right behind them or with them was Fred Ruwajima, one of the Rwandan Patriotic Front leaders who helped invade Rwanda on October 1st, 1990. And James Kabarebe, who's an important name that's going to come up a couple times. He's one of the leading people responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide in Uganda, Rwanda, and Congo. And also Laurent Nkunda Batware, this guy who was the general brought to power in eastern Congo. So all these guys supported Museveni's rise to power in Uganda under absolute butchery. They committed genocide in Uganda, and that genocide was hidden from the world, and it was blamed instead on Milton Obote's government. So Obote was blamed for genocide in the 1980s, just like the Habyarimana government was blamed for genocide in the 1990s in Rwanda. And it's important to understand that in Uganda, they set the stage for what would happen with the invasion of Rwanda, the invasion of Congo, and some of their tactics up in Sudan as well. And they've used certain military strategies to achieve absolute military power in Uganda and in Rwanda and in eastern Congo. And this would be through a tactic that was taught to them by Frank Kitson, a British anti-Mau Mau agent operating in Kenya in the 1960s, 1970s, somewhere around there, 1960s or 70s. Kitson developed this technique, which the U.S. military uses all the time now, of disguising themselves as the enemy and committing atrocities under the cover of night, blaming it on somebody else, who's then considered by the population and by the world at large to be the terrorists. So in Kenya, it was the Mau Mau. The Mau Mau were portrayed as terrorists, and atrocities were committed by the British, led by this guy Kitson. So this is what Museveni did in Uganda. This is what Kagame did in Uganda, and James Kabarebe did in Uganda. And then they went on to do the same thing in Rwanda. They would commit atrocities, and they would blame it on the government of Juvenal Habyarimana. And this again, they invaded October 1st, 1990, and they prosecuted a war in Rwanda, a guerrilla terrorist war from October 1st, 1990 until the end of middle of July 1994. And that is the beginning of the genocide in Rwanda. It has its roots in Uganda. So go back again to 1960 when these Rwandan Tutsi elites fled. Where did they go? They went to the countries, I mentioned that, but they went to the non-aligned movement. They went to the Brazil. They went to the Indonesians. They went to the Vietnamese. They went to the Malaysians. And they said, we are the oppressed peoples of the world. We need to join you in the struggle against oppression by the anti-imperialist devil. Because the Tutsis screamed bloody murder against the Belgians. The Belgians switched their alliance to the Hutus. And the Tutsi elites went to the non-aligned movement. And they got money. And they got weapons. And they got training. And that is what they used to invade Rwanda over and over again throughout the 1960s, the early 1970s, and then finally October 1st, 1990, the preeminent invasion that led to the coup d'etat which brought them to power. And this is important. The Tutsi elites went out, they gained international credibility in front of the United Nations, claiming that they were the victims when in fact they were the absolute oppressors. They're just the most arrogant, elitist, we deserve to rule Rwanda, even Congo, even Sudan. We are the world's greatest people. We're the Jews of Africa, a stateless people, a homeless people. And that is the narrative that the New Yorker has sold to the American public with plenty of support from other books, magazines, radio propaganda, even Democracy Now!, for example. So that's the most important thing. The Tutsis cast as the victims when in fact they're the oppressors, and the Hutus cast as the perpetrators when in fact they were the victims. They were the victims for hundreds of years. And then after 1960, there were a succession of Hutu governments and leading up to the military coup d'etat by Juvenal Habyarimana, which displaced Belgian power and instituted French-backed power in 1972-1973. And Habyarimana's government in Rwanda was a brutal French-backed dictatorship, but it was nothing compared to what would happen after the invasion and the atrocities committed by the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and especially after the Rwandan Patriotic Front victory of July 1994. The Rwandan people thought that the Rwandan Patriotic Front were going to bring democracy to Rwanda. So this is a one-party dictatorship from 1973 until 1990, 91, 92. And when the Tutsi oppressors from Uganda invaded, these are guys from Uganda who had Ugandan passports. They had Ugandan citizenship. They had nice houses. They had expensive cars. Paul Kagame was the director of military intelligence. He was responsible for making sure that Museveni was not assassinated. He was responsible for neutralizing opposition. He was responsible for absolute terrorism under cover of night. He was responsible for safe houses, so-called safe houses, where they had torture, like Abu Ghraib. You know, this guy was nasty. He's known for nastiness. And he's the guy who's in President Rwanda today. So the Tutsis were seen, the Tutsi invaders, the rebels, the guerrillas were portrayed by the international media to be victims, a stateless people, a homeless people. They had a right to return to Rwanda. And why would the world support this narrative? And the answer is because France was in control. France was backing Habyarimana's government. France was benefiting from the profits to be made in Rwanda and any of its peripheral profits through trading in the East African bloc or trading with the Eastern Congo. Remember, Mobutu, from 1965 until his displacement by the U.S. invasion in 1996-97, Mobutu, one of his techniques for controlling the vast Congo was to keep the center, the East and the West, isolated from themselves. So the West was Kinshasa, where Mobutu had his seat of power, was completely separated from the East, which bordered Uganda, Rwanda, Sudan, and Central African Republic, and from Lubumbashi, which bordered Zambia. So this is the basic background to the so-called 100 days that people perceive to be the Rwandan genocide of April 6, 1994 to July 15, 1994. I'm going to pause and let you ask a couple questions. Or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's just all just, you know, when I first started to explore this and explore your writing, I mean, it was just eye-opening that I had eaten up so much of this propaganda and you know, you talk a lot in your writing about the falsification of consciousness, which is probably an even better phrase than this propaganda, because, you know, as you say, they built up this image over decades of being the oppressed and you know, that the Hutus were these nasty butchers who were just, you know, so extreme and so crazy that they were willing to, you know, pick up machetes and start hacking up, you know, everybody that they saw in sight. And perhaps we can try and flesh out a little bit of the actual genocide and how the West was directly involved in this. Now, we do hear a little bit here and there that, France was involved in this. France played some role in fomenting the violence of the Hutu people. But, of course, obviously, in reality, it was not Hutu extremists who blew up President Habyarimana's plane. This was ordered by Paul Kagame and the RPF. And there's also evidence that there were, in fact, white mercenaries, Americans, that were operating in Burundi and in Rwanda as well. And we've got characters like Roger Winter, who are running around and are seen as one of the chief architects of this. But perhaps we could explore that a little bit, and a little bit about why the Pentagon, why the United States was so concerned with getting involved in Rwanda, ostensibly fighting an ally, which would be France.
You raise a lot of very good questions. One thing that I forgot to clarify was that the Tutsis who invaded Rwanda from Uganda were English-speaking Tutsis. They grew up, most of them, in Uganda. They learned the English language. They had Ugandan citizenship under what was called the Pearl of Africa, Britain's Pearl of Africa. This was their major financial economic protectorate. So the French-speaking Tutsis were the Tutsis who stayed behind in Rwanda from 1960 until 1994 were French speakers. They were not trusted by the English-speaking Tutsis who invaded. So the slaughtering of Tutsi people is directly related to Kagame's invasion of Rwanda. So when we talk about Tutsis being killed, we have to remember that there were French-speaking Tutsis, yes, there were English-speaking Tutsis. Those were the elites. And the elite English-speaking Tutsis didn't care about Hutus. They didn't care about Tutsis. They cared about absolute military power. In order to achieve that, they found a backer. The natural backer against a French-backed Hutu-led dictatorship would be the United States and Britain. we have to step back and note that Britain, the United States was, Latin America is to the United States, or the United States is to Latin America, just as France was to Africa. The United States was the main imperial power that controlled Latin America more than anyone else, and Central America. Well, the story for France was the same in Africa. The English, the Brits controlled some of Africa. Belgian Congo, the Congo's controlled by the Belgians, was important. Germany, before World War I, controlled Tanganyika and Rwanda-Urundi and part of Sudan. But the biggest imperial power on the continent was France, and it was led, the imperial machinations were organized and led by, I believe his first name was Jacques, but Jacques Foucart, this French CIA equivalent agent, just like we had ours, you know, as I said, in Latin America. So France controlled this vast region of Africa, from Mali on the far west to Chad and Gabon in the south, Central African Republic, the countries of Mauritania, Mali, Burkina Faso, which was Upper Volta, Niger. Niger is pivotal.
Yes.
The rise of France due to uranium. We could talk about that. But so France was controlling Rwanda-Urundi, this tiny little island nation. And why do I say island? Because it's surrounded by, it's land, completely landlocked. Because it was mountains. It was considered the Switzerland of Africa, just like Uganda was the Pearl of Africa. Rwanda was the Switzerland of Africa, controlled by Belgium and then France. The United States wanted Rwanda for several reasons. One, because we didn't have it. We had the United States, Britain, and Israel were controlling. We had Museveni. We started giving Museveni from 1986 onward. We gave him IMF loans. We gave him World Bank loans. All these corporations flocked to Uganda and set up their nasty little businesses, which weren't so little. That's why you see people all over Uganda starving today. I mean, there's a story of genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity in Uganda is another story related. But so then we had Uganda. We had a war going on in South Sudan from 1983, backing the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which had nothing to do with the liberation of the people, and backing this guy, John Garang. John Garang, by the way, was trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, which is known formerly as the School of the Americas, where we train these military guys who've committed the worst kind of terrorism in Latin American countries. And also, Kagame was trained at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, in case people don't know that. And Fort Leavenworth is a place where they train leaders to deal in psychological operations and overthrowing a country. And that's exactly what happened with Rwanda. We, the American public and Canadian public, were given a massive group of constellation of psychological operations to brainwash us into believing that this was tribal savagery. It began April 6th out of nowhere. People with hoes and machetes rose up and started slaughtering their very neighbors, even their husbands and wives. Nothing could be further from the truth. The United States wanted to get France out of Rwanda, so we sent in this guerrilla force. Remember, there's layers and layers. So on one level, if it came down to it, France and the United States would work together to defeat the bloody Arab terrorists, or they'd work together to defeat a uprising of a bunch of niggers. I mean, this is what the imperial power structure did. But on another level, you've got French corporations, French interests. Jean-Christophe Mitterrand, for example, gave the plane to Juvenal Habyarimana, the small elite plane that was shot down on approach to Kigali in April 6, 1994. Because Jean-Christophe Mitterrand had massive interests in Rwanda, profits to be made, just like Jean-Christophe Mitterrand has massive interests in Cameroon under Paul Biya, the dictator there for many years, still there for many years. So we wanted to get rid of France. We wanted to get Rwanda. We wanted to have control of this little island nation. We did that. We achieved it. Halliburton came in 1994, 95, set up military bases, built a bigger, better U.S. embassy with barbed wire, bigger walls, which is absolute fortress in Kigali, and used this as a base to invade the Congo and overthrow our own former collaborator, Mobutu Sese Seko. And the Congo was the big prize. But also, Rwanda on the other side has Tanzania. And just across the border from Rwanda, in Tanzania, on the other side of Lake Victoria, you have Barrick Gold Corporation has at least four, maybe six properties. And Barrick Gold Corporation, of course, is international advisors included George Herbert Walker Bush, and international directors include former Prime Minister of Canada Brian Mulroney, former U.S. Senator Howard Baker, and Edward N. Nayes, who is one of the chief propagandists in the world today, involved in the business of propaganda, the business of perception management for corporations, which means whitewashing what corporations do in places like Tanzania, where they butcher people at will, they bury people alive in their minds, and then they want to, if they have to cover it up, they put the gears in power to cover it up through these agencies. And this guy Edward N. Nayes, who's the board of directors of Barrick Gold at one time, was connected to this, one of the world's leading institutions of a corporate PR propaganda spin. So we wanted to get rid of France and Rwanda, and that's exactly what happened. The United States marched in. France, in the beginning, sent in paratroopers. They fought off the first invasion by the Rwandan Patriotic Front in October of 1990, forced the Rwandan Patriotic Front back into Uganda. The RPF then fortified its operations, recast its strategy, and started attacking Rwanda from Uganda, from the hills in southern Uganda, secretly going in, committing atrocities, murdering, butchering, slaughtering people left and right, forcing 1.2 million, mostly Hutu people, from the north of Rwanda over the course of the next 4 years, so that by April 6, 1994, the date, the first day of the so-called 100 days, the date of the assassination of the president of Rwanda and the president of Burundi in that plane, so-called plane crash, as Philip Gurevich described it. By then, there were 1.2 million Hutu people living in absolute poverty and destitution in Rwanda, because from 1990 to 1991, 92, 89, the IMF and the World Bank shoved our structural adjustment policies down the throats of the Rwandan people. We created poverty. We created less education for the people. We took away their educational opportunities. We created rising infant mortality. All of the basic indicators of suffering you see occurred after the IMF structural adjustment policies. Now, Javier Mana took on these IMF policies because he was being forced to do so, because he's under attack. He's cast as the perpetrator, when in fact he was running whether it's you like it or not, it was a dictatorship. Whether you like dictatorship or not, it was still a sovereign country run by supposedly the rules of the international so-called community, the international jurisprudence. And you don't go around theoretically invading nations like this. Of course, we do it all the time. So Javier Mana was invaded. He was cast as the perpetrator when the Tutsis elites came in and committed these massive atrocities, wiping entire villages of Hutu people off the map, creating 1.2 million refugees over the next 4 years. Human Rights Watch, and at the time it was African Rights, was a division, subdivision of Human Rights Watch. They sent in their people, which would be Alison DeForge, who's very famous in the Rwandan community, a heroine who, you know, eventually was prohibited from going into Rwanda under Kagame, which is supposedly proves that her work about the genocide in Rwanda is, you know, not to be contested.
Yes.
In fact,
yes.
It's a piece of her book, her tome on Rwanda is a piece of literary fiction because it casts this story, which was based on her interests. Now, she came from USAID, and people have to realize that the term USAID, United States Agency for International Development, USAID, we've been brainwashed to believe that this has something to do with aid, which has something to do with humanitarianism. It doesn't. It has to do with the Pentagon. It's the soft wing of the Pentagon. It's like the National Endowment for Democracy, or the National Republican Institute, or the National Democratic Institute. These are
extensions.
Extensions, soft power extensions of the Pentagon, of the intelligence community. So Alison DeForge came from USAID, and she went in there with William Chabas, a guy who's one of the leading advocates or proponents of the, you know, this mythology about genocide in Rwanda. And William Chabas is like considered this, you know, scholar saint in the academic community. But Chabas and Alison DeForge and this guy from France, also from, I can't remember the agency in France that was set up that to do this. Servie. Servie is one of these false humanitarian fronts in France, similar to false humanitarian organizations in the United States, that was set up to go in to Rwanda and demonize the government of Juvenal Habyarimana and to provide favorable reportage on the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So cast the RPF as the victims, when in fact they're the invaders, the guerrillas.
Yes.
They don't commit atrocities. If they did commit an atrocity, one atrocity, for example, oh, it turns out the New York Times reported that some woman was raped by an RPF soldier. So one woman was raped by one RPF soldier. The New York Times in 1992, 93, 94 would report this kind of thing, forgetting or ignoring or covering up intentionally that there were entire villages. There were 1.2 million people, survivors. Thousands and thousands of people had been butchered. The RPF would call people to meetings under the pretense that they were going to bring democracy to Rwanda. And they would take people away and massacre them, throw them in mass graves, bury them with bulldozers, incinerate them. They incinerated them in crematoriums. And they had to get rid of skeletons and skulls. And the skeletons and skulls were mostly Hutu people, the majority. This is how they cleared northern Rwanda, how they marched into Rwanda, and how the United States unseated French power in Rwanda. Because France, in the end, was forced not to take a powerful stance against the United States. They couldn't. You couldn't have French soldiers openly fighting U.S. guerrillas in Rwanda and have that be reported in the international press. The only thing would be worse to have would be to have French soldiers openly fighting American soldiers. It just doesn't happen. So they had to back off. France was forced to back off. They lost the war. And they were then cast as participants or organizers in the genocide in Rwanda, which is part of the total mythology of genocide in Rwanda.
It's just it's daunting when you start to break this down. But we've already a couple times now talked about Congo, and this is obviously the way that I perceive what really happened in Rwanda was that this was really about an extension into Congo. So perhaps if we can briefly touch upon this a little bit. Obviously, what's going on in Congo right now and what happened around 1996 when the full-scale invasion began is very complex. But it is an important thing, and you almost can't break apart the genocide in Rwanda and Congo because they ultimately feed into each other. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about that and about the leaders that have taken over in Congo, particularly Laurent Kabila and his alleged son, Joseph Kabila, who hopefully we'll talk about. And that is not his real name, in fact, and he is not even Congolese.
So it makes a great segue to begin this discussion of the Congo by looking at the term extremist Hutu. So here, this is a mind control operation. This is a psychological operation. This is mind control of the Western speaking, Western intelligent news, so-called news consuming public, that there is something called an extremist Hutu.
Yeah.
And if you're not an extremist, what are you? You're a moderate Hutu. What's a moderate Hutu? Well, the moderate Hutus, of course, according to the mythology, the Tutsis were butchered by the extremist Hutus, and the moderate Hutus who collaborated with the Tutsis were also butchered by the extremist Hutus. Now, this makes absolutely no sense. The moderate Hutus who collaborated with the Tutsi invaders were also butchered by the extremist Hutus, and the extremist Hutus killed their own president, who was also an extremist Hutu.
Right. Right.
I mean, it just makes absolute nonsense. Yeah. But the American public is so completely whitewashed by the deep racial stereotypes at work. This is the falsification of African consciousness. And if you want to understand that terminology and understand what has happened to us, you have to read about whiteness. You have to read about white power. You have to read about the falsification of African consciousness. And you go and you read Amos Wilson, who wrote the book, The Falsification of African Consciousness. And you go and you read Chinwezu, who wrote The West and the Rest of Us. And you read Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And you read these books like Race and the Epistemologies of Whiteness by these two American female, I believe they're American, U.S. female academics. But it's a very good breakdown of how whiteness operates. Or you read The Whiteness of Power by Paulette Goodge, a British woman who went to Nicaragua believing she was going to save the world with fantasies that she uncovered in herself later and had the courage to write about and expose. So back to the subject of the extremist Hutus, the moderate Hutus. What is an extremist Hutu? Let's break it down. An extremist Hutu, according to the mythology, is somebody with a machete who goes around slaughtering everybody in his path. They're part of the other mythological terminologies we can look at are Inyenzi. Mm. The term translates from Kinyarwanda, the Rwandan language, to cockroach. And this is a psychological operation. The portrayal in the movie Hotel Rwanda, you see the word cockroach being used by the Hutus as a pejorative term against the Tutsis, a term that was used in Hotel Rwanda, the film, to support the mythological narrative that the Hutus were perpetrating genocide. And in order to perpetrate genocide, you have to dehumanize your opponents. You have to dehumanize the minority people or the indigenous people, which is what we did to Native Americans, which is what happens anywhere there is an actual genocide. You have to dehumanize the people. So the Hotel Rwanda film portrays the Hutu extremists as dehumanizing the Tutsis by labeling them as Inyenzis, cockroaches, something to be exterminated. Well, let's look at this. The term Inyenzi is a term that actually is related to the term Inkotani. These are two terms created by the Tutsi elite guerrillas in the 1960s when they were invading Rwanda and committing massacres under cover of night. They were bombing cafes. They were bombing nightclubs. They were bombing buses, public buses. They were fomenting absolute terrorism in Rwanda in the 1960s. And every time they did this, the Hutu people would, and sometimes the government, the Hutu governments would retaliate. And there were massacres of Tutsi people. The Tutsis, of course, were cast as the victims by the international community, that they were victims of genocide in Rwanda. So the genocide in 1994 has its precursor to the genocide in the 1960s or the genocide in the early 1970s. This is the mythology. The fact is, there are plenty of Tutsi victims. They were victims of absolute butchery by people who should be incarcerated, people who should be brought to trial. But they were not victims of an organized conspiracy to commit genocide ever. There has not been an organized conspiracy to commit genocide, and the International Criminal Tribunal has determined this. They determined that they've acquitted members of the Hutu. And they've only tried Hutus, for example, which shows you how distorted this whole picture is. They haven't tried a single Tutsi, and we know there are plenty of Tutsis who've committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, including James Kabarebe, who led the invasion of the Congo, with Paul Kagame, who led the invasion of the Congo in 1996, with Nkunda Batware, Laurent Nkunda Batware, who became one of these generals who operated in eastern Congo, who led the invasion of Congo in the 1996-97 period, and also this guy Joseph Kabila, who's supposedly the son of Laurent Kabila. Laurent Kabila was assassinated after he threw out the Rwandans and Ugandans and basically offended Banro Gold Corporation from Canada, the director Arnold Kondrat of Banro Gold. He offended him directly, and Kondrat basically said to him, "That's the end of your life if you don't, you know, straighten yourself out," which is basically racist talk to try to put another nigger in line. So Kabila was assassinated. His son was not, Joseph Kabila is not his real name. He was not his son. He was behind James Kabarebe, under the wing of James Kabarebe, his uncle. James Kabarebe is a Tutsi elite from Uganda. Joseph Kabila, alias Joseph Kabila, his real name is Hippolyte Kanambe, and he was under the wing of James Kabarebe during the invasion of Zaire in 1996-97, supported by the Pentagon, as they marched across the Congo, and the first thing they did was butcher hundreds of thousands of Hutu people. Hundreds of thousands of innocent, unarmed Hutu men, women, and children. To continue and advance the genocide against the Hutu people, which was begun on October 1st, 1990. The only organized, clearly organized, planned extermination against a people in Rwanda. So we have the mythology that the Hutus committed an organized conspiracy of genocide against Tutsis in Rwanda, which did not happen. And we have the opposite story, which is that the Tutsis invaded, the Tutsi elites invaded, committed genocide against the Hutu people from the very beginning and all the way across the Congo and to this very day in Rwanda, because they have policies in place for sterilization against Hutu males and females in Rwanda today, for example. And so that's how the story has been turned upside down. So in order to have justification to invade the Congo, Paul Kagame used the argument that there were all these extremist Hutus in Congo. When Kagame invaded 1990, from the next 4 years, they forced their way to Kigali through a strategy of talk and fight and committing atrocities under cover of dark, committing atrocities called pseudo-operations. That's what this guy Frank Kitson defined as it was named pseudo-operations, to disguise yourself as the enemy, commit atrocities, and then march in to rescue the people from yourself, in fact, but blaming it all on the enemy. This is exactly what Kagame did in Rwanda over 1990 to 1994, achieved military superiority from Uganda with World Bank and IMF and Pentagon support and Israeli support. And the Israeli kingpin at the time was this guy David Kimchi. And the U.S. agent of covert operations for the Rwandan Patriotic Front was this guy you already mentioned, Roger Winter, who's also the guy who helped bring Museveni to power in the 1980s, and also the guy who helped bring John Garang to conclude the war in southern Sudan and achieve the creation of the world's most recently independent, so-called independent nation of South Sudan. And these are all the same military strategies. So in order to invade the Congo, they had Zaire. Kagame used the justification that he had to invade eastern Congo to get rid of all these Hutu extremists who were armed, who had committed genocide in his country against his people, and they were going to be invading. They were trying to invade Rwanda. They were attacking Rwanda. They were going to take over Rwanda again. This is nonsense. The people who fled, who are the extremist Hutus? These are any Hutu people who saw Kagame and the RPF for what they were: absolute military butchers.
Exactly.
Massacring, slaughtering people, torturing people by any means necessary, achieving coup d'etat, killing the presidents. 1.2 million refugees who'd seen their families killed, they'd seen their wives tortured, they'd survived through the worst kind of atrocities, running from the RPF, and then they were hunted into the Congo. And the justification was that they were armed. So let's look at the army of Juvenal Habyarimana. In 1990, when the RPF invaded, the army of Juvenal Habyarimana was very weak. There were the presidential guards. They were trained by France. They were probably trained also by Israel. Mobutu over in Kinshasa was also trained by Israel, elite Israel agents and French agents and U.S. agents. And they had their special forces to maintain presidential power in Rwanda. And when the French saw the RPF invading, the world was suddenly aware in 1994 that there were people being butchered, and Tutsis were being butchered left and right. Who was killing them? That's a very good question. We go back to these terminologies, the Inkotani, the Inyenzi, and then we have this one, the Interahamwe, which has become centered in the American mind as, you know, the Taliban of Rwanda or the Janjaweed of Rwanda. Any of these boogeymen that we create as the supposed perpetrators of the worst kind of atrocities imaginable to humanity, when in fact it's really nothing like that. Who were the Interahamwe? The Interahamwe, number two, was Robert Kajuga, a Tutsi. Supposedly, according to Hotel Rwanda and according to Philip Gurevich and according to the Shooting Dogs movie, which also it had another title for the American public, and they changed it for the American public. It was produced in Britain it was called something else in the United States. But the Interahamwe were supposedly these Hutu extremists that went about massacring people at roadblocks. This is just mythology. There were roadblocks set up. But are you saying that the people of Rwanda don't have a right to defend themselves from the invasion of a guerrilla force which has been committing massive atrocities over the previous 4 years and is backed and organized and created by the very people who maintained the oppression of the Hutu people for over 100 years? Is Habyarimana not supposed to defend his country against an invasion by a guerrilla army? Yes. According to the world powers, Habyarimana's mistake was to try to defend his country. There was an arms embargo against Habyarimana, but there was no arms embargo against the RPF in Uganda. Their weaponry was brought in. The Habyarimana government is, the Human Rights Watch went about producing reports which claim that the Habyarimana government brought in all these arms and France brought in all these arms. So what? It's meaningless. First of all, Human Rights Watch cannot be trusted. Second of all, the arms that the government brought in, some of them were brought in, such as supposedly machetes, which were brought in by the government to commit genocide. This is the one of the cornerstones of the supposed conspiracy to commit genocide in Rwanda over those so-called 100 days, that there were hundreds of thousands of machetes brought in the planification of genocide in January of 1994, getting set for April when the extremist Hutus would kill their own extremist Hutu president. Nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Let's look at where those machetes came from. Some of them came from a British businessman. Some of them came in, which defeats the argument that they were brought in by the Hutu government. Some of them came in on World Bank and IMF loans. They came in for agriculture. In January of 1994, the Habyarimana government was using IMF loans to purchase machetes on the international market, being sold by international businessmen, which serves capitalism and made capitalism very happy. So he was doing exactly what he was expected to do. He was given IMF loans, and he was supposed to turn that money around to benefit elites in the West. Most of the money from the IMF and the World Bank goes back to the very agencies or institutions that, or banks especially, that funnel the money in the first place. It doesn't trickle down to the people. It did just the opposite. It has the effect of destroying the people's lives. The people in Rwanda from 1990 to 1994 had seen rising suffering, rising, as I said already, that the indicators were of poverty were extreme, and the people were unhappy, and they were unhappy with the Habyarimana government, and they were willing to accept the possibility that the RPF was going to bring democracy. They believed the propaganda. And then there were the Hutus who did not believe it, and those are the supposed extremists, who basically said, we cannot trust the Kagame, we cannot trust the Tutsis, we cannot trust their international military backers. They're slaughtering us left and right. Are we going to stand around and just be slaughtered? Or should we pick up a gun and fight back? And I'm on, from this point of view, I would be an extremist Hutu, just like I would be a member of the Black Panther Party, that the Black Panthers had a right to self-defense when their communities were under absolute military intelligence attack under the secret programs of the FBI. So the so-called extremist Hutus were ordinary Hutus who knew perfectly well that they were going to be butchered, that the RPF was a dangerous force, that they could see the writing on the wall, and they wanted to stand up for themselves. And that's where the oppression and violence against Tutsi victims, real victims, innocent Tutsi people in Rwanda comes from. It was part of a civil war. They were targeted because they were Tutsis. Remember, this is not a tribal thing. It was not because they had long noses and high, craniums, and because they were taller than the Hutu people. That is all imperial racist nonsense. It was economic reasons. It was familial connections or non-connections. It was because they were known to have or believed to have some connection to the Rwandan Patriotic Front. It was because they sent their sons secretly on buses in the early 1990s to be trained by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And their sons were French-speaking Tutsis who arrived in these Rwandan RPF camps and were subject to the egregious violence of Paul Kagame, which means if he did not trust them and he didn't trust French-speaking Tutsis, they would be repressed within these military camps, sometimes disappeared and killed. Sometimes they were brought into the army, successfully indoctrinated into the RPF, and then used to support the invasion of Rwanda, which involved infiltration. It involved sending soldiers back in civilian attire to infiltrate military institutions, to infiltrate social and cultural institutions, to infiltrate villages. And when the RPF arrived, they had their soldiers in place. They were able to take the people down, and the people didn't know what happened. They didn't know what hit them in many cases, in many villages. And this is exactly what the RPF did in Eastern Congo. So that was a long answer to your question about the Congo, which barely touched on the Congo. But the important point is the the argument for Kagame to invade the Congo over and over and over, that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, BBC, National Public Radio, Democracy Now! Have continued to use, is that there were these forces for the democratic liberation of Rwanda, the extremist Hutus, the genocidaires who committed genocide in their own country and then fled to the Congo, and they allied themselves with this nasty dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko. And this is where the narrative once again starts to fall apart, because the United States, everybody knows the CIA supported Mobutu for decades. So if Mobutu was supported by the CIA, how can this story that Keith Harmon Snow is telling you have any truth to it? Because the CIA and the Pentagon would not take out the French-backed government of Habyarimana Mana and then march against their own dictatorship in the Congo, would they? No, they couldn't do that. It makes no sense. Well, you've got layers and layers and layers. And Mobutu had served his purpose for decades. There was money to be made. The Mobutu government was supported for the most part by Republican administration after Republican administration, the Reagan administrations, especially the Bush administration, Bush 1, supported Mobutu. There were Republican-aligned corporations that had more connections to the Republicans than they did to the Democrats that were making the money on the Congo. These are mining corporations. These are agricultural corporations. These are oil companies, especially in the far west of the Congo, where we have big Western oil operations, petroleum operations off of Matadi, the small piece of the Congo that sticks out to the Pacific Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean. So along comes Bill Clinton. He takes Rwanda, and then he marches with Uganda, and then he marches into Zaire and unseats a Republican-backed dictator. And remember, there are all kinds of peripheral machinations going on. You have to look at the guy that was in power for all those decades, Omar Bongo in Gabon. What did Gabon have to do with this? Well, Gabon is right next to Makatadi. Gabon is oil. Gabon is timber.
Yeah.
Gabon is uranium. Gabon is diamonds. And then you have Namibia, diamonds, De Beers, Maurice Tebelspan, one of the closest friends of William Jefferson and Hillary Clinton, sails off Martha's Vineyard with the Clintons. Who is this guy, Maurice Tebelspan? What is his connection to De Beers? What is his connection to the largest mining company in South Africa, which was based in the Sephardic Jews that arrived in South Africa and spread and arrived eventually up in Lubumbashi and took control of the diamond trade in the Congo, Zaire, for all those years and built Israel on the blood diamonds of the Congo? Who are these people? Who are these Jewish guys that run the show in the Congo, that Zaire backed with Mobutu? This is where the Clinton administration comes along, marches into the Congo with their military forces, Uganda and Rwanda, putting this guy, Laurent Kabila, at the front as a puppet. And Kabila was known to be a longtime, thorn in the side of Mobutu, the perfect cover for a U.S. military invasion. But the bottom line is the Clinton Democratic-backed administration unseated U.S. power in Zaire by getting rid of Mobutu, reshuffling the cards, reshuffling the story, leaving a lot of people in power in Zaire, in Congo, after 1996, after the first war in the Congo, 1996-97, such as families who'd been supporting Mobutu, making billions off of the Congo for years. We never hear about them. We only hear about Mobutu. The story, the mythology, the psychological operation about Mobutu is Mobutu Sese Seko. He wore a leopard hat and a cane. He ran the country into the ground. He destroyed what Belgium built. Typical black nigger. Typical nigger. He exported all the profits to Swiss banks. Well, they don't ever ask who runs the Swiss banks that make all the money on Mobutu. And then there's all the guys that brought behind the scenes, the French, Belgian, Israeli, British, and American mercenaries who kept Mobutu in power, and the corporations. The Continental Grain, which is very close to the Republican administrations, very close to Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz, and these guys under the Reagan administration. And very, very close to Henry Kissinger. And this brings up agencies like the International Rescue Committee. Henry Kissinger's on the board of the IRC. The IRC counts dead bodies in the Congo and produces this document that says 3.5 million people have been killed in the Congo since 1998. 1998 to 2001 or 2002, which is another whitewash because the war began in 96, the Pentagon invaded. If we exclude the years 96, 97, we exclude the atrocities, the Pentagon. If there's any accounting for atrocities in the Congo, nobody knows the Pentagon was there. Nobody knows U.S. covert forces were there. You know, these people won't be held to account because the historiography has been created in such a way that the lions do not tell the story of the hunt. So Clinton reshuffled power in Congo, and Kagame marched across the Congo with his agents of atrocities, including the current president, who's a Tutsi elite in Kinshasa, this guy supposedly named Joseph Kabila. So the Tutsi Rwandans have a Trojan horse in Kinshasa who's making sure that Rwanda and Uganda and Burundi maintain the control over the eastern Congo. It doesn't matter how many dead bodies turn up as long as they're not, and even if they are, sometimes they're American covert forces. Sometimes they're French, but mostly they're Hutus. They're Congolese. They're Congolese of various different ethnologies, which means there have been multiple genocides in the Congo. But, you know, nobody's counting Congolese because mining companies like Banro Gold Corporation or the company associated with one of Clinton's directors of national security, a guy named Walter Kansteiner. Walter Kansteiner's on a board of directors of an organization which supposedly cares about rhinoceroses and lions and tigers and elephants, and that would be the African Wildlife Foundation. But Kansteiner is also a director of Moto Gold, and Moto Gold happens to be in one of the blood-drenched areas of eastern Congo, a corporation from the United States that's ripping the gold out of eastern Congo through helicopters and planes that fly into remote landing strips with the support of, you know, military Mission Aviation, MAF, Mission Aviation Foundation, these guys who were named by Charlotte Dennett and Colby, Gerald Colby, in their book, Thy Will Be Done, which is the absolute Bible on the CIA use of missionaries and corporations to destroy Latin America. Thy Will Be Done. And Mission Aviation Foundation, and there's another school, I can't think of the name at the moment, but these missionaries are directly connected to the penetration of Rwanda, the penetration of the Congo today. And that's how Moto Gold gets its gold out of the eastern Congo. So there's a lot of stuff for people to chew on. Maybe I should take a breather and let you ask a question.
Yeah, well, I mean, as we said before, I mean, this is just so complex, and there are so many different little facets. And then, of course, right now, I mean, we see in Congo today, we still have the FDLR, which is, again, one of these groups which is seen as the ultimate perpetrator of violence in the Congo. We also have the M23 movement, which is ostensibly sort of admitted that it is, in fact, some sort of proxy force of the Rwandans. But, again, people don't really seem to notice this or pay attention or anything. And it is still startling to me to this day the amount of I mean, it's not even really just propaganda. I mean, it's almost just, like you said, I mean, you can just mention a word like Interahamwe, and then suddenly you have this image in your head, and that's all you really need to know. You know, you could just say the 100 days, never forget, all of this stuff. But obviously, Keith, we could talk for another 2 hours and probably barely even scratch the surface. But in closing right now, You know, let's just tell the listeners a little bit about, the sort of current structure going on right now in Central Africa. It's obviously we've got AFRICOM running all over the place. We've got secret bases in Congo, which is something that people don't really seem to know about. You know, I mean, we hear about the base in Djibouti, and we hear about some of these other smaller bases, Ethiopia, obviously a large one, Uganda, Rwanda as well, but we've got secret bases in Congo as well. We've got the Red Menace from China coming in, and Paul Kagame sort of leaning a little bit towards the Chinese here and there. But just to set up the sort of situation that we have right now, because it seems as if seemingly there is a little end to this sort of bloodshed with these various proxy forces going on. And all the time, of course, the Western multinational corporations are still reaping massive profits out of this country. So, what do we see on the horizon in the future right now?
Sure. I thank you for pointing out that the Pentagon has secret bases in the Congo, for example. They're all over the place. Hundreds and hundreds. What is it? There's several articles have been produced recently. I've talked about it previously. Hundreds of covert operations going on every single day all over the world. And of course, they're happening in Central Africa, just absolutely happening in Central Africa. People need to understand that the Congo is strategic to the United States from 1960 onward because of cobalt.
Yes.
Not diamonds. Industrial diamonds are important, but we can get those off the seabed of Namibia, off the seabed of Angola. We can get them from Angola itself. We can get them from South Africa. We can get them from Botswana, which is in, you know, the diamond bloodshed genocides that I talk about in my article, Blood Diamond. But back to cobalt. Cobalt is essential for planes, trains, automobiles, tank armor, ship hulls, oil derricks, any drilling equipment that goes deep sea, submersibles, submarines, undersea, autonomous vehicles, drones. What are they called?
UAVs.
UAVs. UUVs. We've got UAVs in the sky, and we got UUVs under the sea, all over the place, off the coast of the United States. People don't even know this. And then, for deep pressure, deep sea, high pressure, low pressure, nuclear weapons, nuclear reactors, the space station, you have to have cobalt and you have to have uranium. Cobalt comes from the Congo. That's the importance of Mobutu for all those years. It's the importance of cobalt connection. But as far as the importance of having the Pentagon filled bases, I mentioned these guys who were behind Mobutu. One of them was a guy named the Blattner family from New Jersey and Belgium and Israel, the Blatners. There's David Blattner, there's Elwin Blattner, and there's one more. I can't remember his name at the moment. And then there was their father, who was involved with Mobutu in the 1980s. And then Elwin and David and the other Blattner took over and started expanding businesses in the late 80s and early 90s, right through the wars. They backed all sides on the wars. They were getting their profits out. Planes were shipping in weapons while their merchandise was being shipped out on the Blattner planes and the Blattner boats. And Philippe de Moerlus from Belgium, another major interloper behind the war and the genocides in the Congo, Rwanda. And the guy that built the base for the Pentagon, meaning he has the construction equipment and the logging equipment in Kisangani, which is very rural Congo. That's the subject of that book, A Bend in the River by V.S. Naipaul. Sorry, that's the geographical location of the fictional book, A Bend in the River by V.S. Naipaul. Kisangani, in the remote rainforest, you've got this Pentagon base going up, being built by this Belgian or French, I can't remember, but I've met the guy, I know him really well, and it's being built secretly, it's never been reported, it's one of the many bases of the Pentagon that are going down in Africa. Go back to the subject of all these mercenary forces and all these different militias and the alphabet soup of different militias that have occupied the Congo since the first invasion, the ADFL, which was the Alliance for the Democratic Liberation of Congo Zaire, which is just a nonsensical term because it was actually Rwanda and Uganda. It wasn't Congolese people. It wasn't Laurent Kabila. It wasn't Congolese people who just rose up and decided that they'd had enough of Mobutu. That's mythology. But one of the institutions that of the forces in the Congo, the very real forces in the Congo, was the Forces for the Democratic Liberation of Rwanda. And these were Rwandan Hutus who left Rwanda, armed themselves, or left with weapons that were not confiscated, or were able to reacquire weapons after they were confiscated. The mythology is that they occupied these refugee camps that Kagame had to destroy. They had to hunt these people down because they were going to go back and commit genocide in Rwanda, et cetera, et cetera. The reality is this was the army of Juvenal Habyarimana. They had lost the war. They had fought. You know, they had a right to fight. They had a right to run. They had a right to take their guns with them. They had a right to fight back in the Congo. And they're cast as the world's preeminent, you know, most violent terrorist institutions like, for example, the Taliban, etc. But the FDLR are very misunderstood. And then you've got the false FDLR, because the FDLR in Congo were destroyed years ago. They were hunted down and persecuted. Not only the genocide against the Hutu people, which included killing off the military contingents, but over the years from 1996, 97, 98, 2001, 2004, there have been different military operations by Kagame, by Museveni, by the United Nations, which is another imperialist occupation force in the Congo, to hunt down the FDLR, the true FDLR. And so thousands of FDLR actually fled to Congo Brazzaville, which was another French-backed dictatorship in Central Africa. It's the small Congo. And then there were the FDLR who put their guns down and accepted repatriation to Rwanda and joined Kagame. They were given positions in the military, the Rwandan Defense Forces, which is the latest name of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And then they were sent back into the Congo to hunt down the remaining FDLR. And then there were the FDLR that were created that had nothing to do with FDLR, but they were created in the Congo by Kagame. They're fictional, but they're really Kagame's troops who infiltrated Eastern Congo, who are accused of being or portrayed as FDLR to take the pressure off and do that pseudo-operation thing that I described. They're actually Kagame's troops committing atrocities, blamed on the FDLR, justifying Kagame sending in real troops in uniform to supposedly hunt down these FDLR who are actually trading in gold and diamonds and everything else with and coltan for cell phones with Paul Kagame, shipping the stuff right out through Rwanda. So the FDLR are vastly misunderstood. It's that more important are the M23 movement. The previous to the M23 was the CNDP. Before that was various machinations, various alphabet soup names, different militias. At one point, there were 27 militias operating in the Congo, you know, up in the north, supported by Museveni, supported by the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which is backed by the United States, supported by Jean-Pierre Bemba, who was backed by Portugal and had connections to the Blatners. And, you know, this is the corporate military allegiances and alliances of military factions creating chaos under which the people are removed from the land, the Congolese people are removed from the land, so that whatever it is that's of value can be taken by the world, taken by the white people in the end, using their black military oppressors, their black intelligence oppressors. I call them the, and this is what Franz Fanon wrote about in White Skin, Black Masks, or Black Mask, White Skin. I can never remember the title exactly. And also in his other most important book, which name escapes me at the moment. So back to these different militias, the CNDP, the Congolese Rally for Democracy, the militias of the 1997-98, these are the Rwandan and Ugandan forces. They're always in the Congo. They've infiltrated. They've managed to work their way into the Congo, just like Sudan People's Liberation Army worked its way into achieving military dominance and the new state of South Sudan. And that is by infiltrating, committing atrocities, blaming it on the enemy, and then holding peace talks and having their soldiers be actually, through a UN process, be
integrated
into a multinational force in that's called now the Congolese Army, the forces, armed forces of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which include soldiers from Rwanda. Now, this is a coup d'etat by Paul Kagame to get his soldiers into the Congolese army because they are not loyal to the Congo. And this is part of Kagame's strategy. And then he's got his Trojan horse, Joseph Kabila, in Kinshasa, along with other Rwandan agents who were put into the Congolese government forcibly against the people of the Congo, against the government of the Congo, under the claim that they had to settle this war. And in order to settle the war, you had to give high positions to the military and civilian commanders of these militias that were sent in by Rwanda. That's a coup d'etat. That's exactly what happened under Habyarimana. It's exactly how the RPF was able to defeat Habyarimana by getting involved in peace talks and being seen as a legitimate claim to power in Rwanda, when in fact they should have been arrested by Interpol, arrested and tried for the worst war crimes imaginable. There is no one on the planet more brutal than Paul Kagame or James Kabarebe and the atrocities that they committed, and the top 40 who've been named by the Spanish indictments that you mentioned in the beginning. So it's time to wrap up, and I just want to point out that if you hear FDLR, you don't know what you're talking about. If you try to talk about them, you got to understand that even people who worked on the Congo for years don't have a grasp sometimes of the intricacies and the shifting allegiances and alliances of the forces for the democratic liberation of Rwanda. Hutu extremists, these terminologies, Inkotani, Inyenzi, it's an attack on your mind. And you have to shut down and shut off the propaganda system to be able to come to some understanding of the fact that you're suffering from mental illness. Because this is making it possible for us, meaning a white, predominantly white, imperial power to control, occupy, and destroy the lives of millions of people all over the planet at this very moment, with plenty of black African Americans supporting that process. So we could talk at length about these things. Anything I forgot that I wanted to point out? Yeah, Roger Winter, FDLR, covered the main, you know, the main points that I've made some notes about here. I don't think there's Philip Gourevitch, you know, the Atlantic Monthly. I mean, if you're reading the Atlantic Monthly, you're contributing to your own mental illness. And the same thing with the New York Times. You just have to understand. Read Jacques Ellul. Read Manufacturing Consent or The Political Economy of Human Rights, Volumes 1 and 2 by Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky.
Well, and I would say that if you really want to learn a lot about this, you've got to read all of your articles. And I mean, they are extremely well detailed with lots of footnotes, and the footnotes will bring you on to, you know, other great writers and things like that. So perhaps before we wrap up here, Keith, please tell everybody where they can go to read your work and to support you, because you know, I know that you're out there struggling like so many of us are.
So my first website was All Things Pass, P-A-S, allthingspass.com. And there's tons of information there. My early articles when I was working in the Congo, they're all very relevant. There isn't a single article there that is not relevant today, including the articles about Mongolia and Afghanistan and India, etc. And about climate mayhem and about nuclear power, nuclear technologies. So the next website was consciousbeingalliance.com, and that's where I'm publishing now, and that one has even become unmanageable. So I'm working on – I got a guy building me a new website right now. So that's consciousbeingalliance, allthingspass.com, and there's plenty of stuff to search on and find. And I'd like to close by pointing out that if people have listened to this and they feel overwhelmed and they feel that it's futile to try to understand, or they feel frustrated or depressed, see a therapist. Seriously, because, you know, the propaganda system creates this state of mind. Mental health, true mental health, is understanding where you've been deceived. You don't need to understand all these facts and figures and details about what happened in Central Africa. What you need to understand is that you have to shut off the propaganda system completely. And then people say, well, if I'm not supposed to read the New York Times because it's contributing to my own mental illness, what am I supposed to read? And I would say, reassess that very question. Where does that question come from? What are you supposed to read? Why are you supposed to read? What if it's not about what you're supposed to read, but about being?
Mm.
Study the Upanishads. I mean, do people study the Upanishads? People who read the New York Times every day, they tell me, well, I read the Times, I read the Globe, I read this, I read that, I read all. And then at the end of the day, I'm an informed human being. I can sit down at dinner and talk intelligently about what's going on in, you know, Iraq, or Zimbabwe, or Brazil, or Papua New Guinea, or Washington. And I'd say bullshit, because you're just sitting down with a bunch of people who mostly, for the most part, are indoctrinated like me and you. And unless you break out of that system and find another way, it's not going to change. Nothing's going to change. The world's not going to change. It's not going to be at a better place. And we're not going to stop this kind of violence anyway. And that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of people fighting against it in Central Africa. You want to support Central Africa? Go to Central Africa if you can, or find out who the true resistance fighters against imperialism in Central Africa are. And you won't find them on Democracy Now! You won't find them even in my pages, because I don't talk about my sources, but it's easy to figure out where they are if you really want to know. So that's where the truth lies. It lies with the people struggling at this very minute against the oppression of our government and the oppression of USAID and the oppression of Doctors Without Borders and the oppression of CARE and the oppression of UNICEF and the oppression of Save the Children and the oppression of
the Enough Project
and social media magnates who are creating new social media to save the world. It's just another kind of oppression.
Mm. Of course, Kony 2012, all of that baloney and bullshit that we were sold on. Well, Keith Harmon Snow, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. It was just absolutely excellent. Like I said, you are just one of my favorite journalists on the planet, and it was such a pleasure to talk with you.
I appreciate you taking the time. I hope that people can – I hope you can edit this if it needs to be, and I hope people can salvage – something from our discussion.
Oh no, I think everybody will, and like you said, this it's a lot of information to take in, but it's worth it, it's not that complex once you start breaking this stuff down and you can start to see what's really going on out there. And like you said, if you can sit down and stomach through the New York Times and the New Yorker and all those other things, I think you could take a little bit of time out of your day and listen to our conversation. So once again, Keith, thank you so much.
Can I add my final closing point?
Please do.
You'll have to edit it so that this fits within the hour or whatever, but one of my teachers, a black African-American professor formerly from the University of Massachusetts, Dr. Enoch Page, taught me and some of my friends this very important lesson or statement. Are you going to sacrifice your children to save your body? And my response to that is, what are you waiting for? People know what needs to be done, but we're basically afraid to make the changes in our life because those changes are so profound that it frightens us. And it's when people step into the path of those significant changes, which are not about profits or money or even how long our bodies exist on the planet. It has nothing to do with the lifespan. We don't know what happens to our flesh and blood once we expire. And that spiritual, philosophical perspective that what happens, how we live our lives, is more important than the length of time we're here, is what I think underpins the statement, are you going to sacrifice your children to save your body? And that's why I say, what are you waiting for?
What else can you say? Thank you so much, Keith.
Good night. Take care. Uhuru.
Okay, everybody, so that was our conversation with Keith Harmon Snow. I understand this was a much longer podcast than I intended it to be, but I really just wanted everyone to just listen to Keith because I think he's a great speaker and he just has just a wealth of information. But please do go and check out the show notes and check out his website. His articles go into much more depth, much more detail than we could have ever done here, even in the hour and a half long podcast. But thank you so much for listening. You've, of course, been listening to Porkins Policy Radio, and you can find this podcast and all of my other podcasts and my writing by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Of course, always follow me through the RSS feed, through email, on Twitter, at Porkins Policy, and follow, subscribe, to my YouTube channel, which is, of course, youtube.com/1138Porkins. And before I completely sign off, I just want to say thanks to all the listeners lately. I've been getting lots of great responses, some wonderful emails, including one from a woman in Germany, Zena. Thank you so much. And also to Joseph Davis of jdavismemphis.com, who has been very supportive of the website, in adding my website to his blog role and promoting the show. Thanks a lot, Joseph. It's really been very helpful in getting the message out there. And if you haven't seen, please check out my appearances on Trans Resistor Radio and also on Clandestine. Well, with that, I'm going to leave it there, and thank you so much, and I'll talk to you very soon. Tell you.
I can sing like an elephant and woman moving on the road. They got to sing together, singing clapping hands. They got to group together, they are singing. Ay, ay, ay. Oh, oh, oh.
Psychedelic man, no, 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 psychedelic man.